Interested in being a community partner? Well, contact us by email at partners@kpft.org. Thanks for your interest in our Community Partners program. This is KPFT Houston.
Welcome to So What's Your Story, the only program in Houston devoted to storytelling, and it's only here on Houston's community station, KPFT. I'm your host, Hank Rubicek, and along with the best crew on radio, Greg Audell, Warren Holloman, Mary Edgerton, Eric Heen, Chris Gorman, Harwood Taylor, and Tatiana Gago, we celebrate the power of story by placing the spotlight on tellers who take us on journeys through windows of their soul. If you've been a Pacifica listener for a while, you know that pledge drives are always around the corner. I know that's frustrating because we're always around the corner and because we live in a world where it makes it tough to find some extra cash. But we do need your help. KPFT is Houston's community radio, and this program, So What's Your Story, represents community radio at its best. And although programmers aren't paid, no one listens and says, well, you know what do you expect? It's a terrible program because no one is paid. You expect excellence, and that is exactly what you get. So let's not run the risk of tuning in and hearing, that's right, silence. So if you can, please go to www.kpft.org, then to donations. Tell us how you want to make your payment and scroll to So What's Your Story as the program that you wish to support. Or give us a call at 713-526-5738, JAM KPFT. We're the best station in town, listener sponsored. Corporate free, 90.1 KPFT, Houston's community station. Every so often, I like to ambush students enrolled in my storytelling class to prove to them what they sometimes have a hard time proving to themselves, that they too are storytellers. So tonight, to celebrate a belated Mother's Day and usher in Father's Day, I asked them to gather a few treasured reflections about mom, dad, and even grandma, and deliver narratives to kindle our hearts. They are Martha Barvin, Nunetsi Martinez, and Robert Gonzalez. Hello to all of you. Martha, let's start with you. You are studying business and art. You spend time doing yoga, volunteering, and enjoying family. So what about this business and art connection?
Thank you, Professor. I went to college for accounting, and my career has been in business. So when I retired, I wanted to develop the creative side of my brain and body and started taking art classes at the University of Houston downtown. I've taken drawing, photography, and now storytelling.
Fabulous. Okay, fabulous. And obviously you're looking for your dream job, right?
I'm living it.
You're living a dream.
I'm living the life.
Yeah, your story focuses on your dad, and it contains a whole jumble of emotions, which I love, and I call it, I think justifiably so, the perfect storm. Mm-hmm. I think our listeners will know why in just a moment. Tell us your story.
My dad always wanted to take us on inexpensive, yet hopefully thrilling vacations. He was a World War II veteran, started his own business, and could fix anything. He thought he was near God, and we did too. He was our hero. When I was 12, he decided that we would rent a houseboat to navigate from the Chesapeake Bay up to Canada. So all eight of us, including my sister's dog, Macaroni, crammed into our old station wagon and drove 2 days from West Virginia to the Chesapeake Bay. We finally arrived, and we pulled up to the dock where we saw a man standing next to a little houseboat. You've heard of tiny houses like on TV where two people can barely fit in at one time? Well, this was the boat version of a tiny house. There was no way we were going to fit into this thing. Turns out that the boat could only accommodate five. However, my father could not afford a larger boat, so he quickly told my brothers to hide so they would not be counted. In addition to the risk of having too many people on board, my dad lied. When the man asked, "Have you ever driven a boat in the ocean?" My dad's reply was, "I can handle it," which I knew meant he had never done this before. So now we're on this boat, too many people, some in hiding, and my dad had never driven on the ocean. It got worse. There were not enough life jackets for all of us. So my dad told me that he and I would not need them. Last time I heard about that was on the Titanic, when there were not enough life jackets, and you remember what happened then. But I was proud because my dad had picked me. Even though I was not exactly confident that I could swim in the Atlantic Ocean with sharks. But thank goodness my sister cared about her dog, Macaroni, who was wearing my life jacket. Did I mention also that no one under 16 was allowed to drive the boat? Guess who just aged from 12 to 16? Look, my dad was my hero, and I really wasn't too worried until my mother, the voice of reason in our house, said, "Art, do you know what you're doing? We are responsible for these kids." He didn't answer her and shouted, "Here we go, boys," as we shoved off from the dock with a big cheer, "Hooray!" My dad called us boys, including all the females in our family. We assumed it was what they called each other in World War II, like we were his army troop. Well, we're off and my dad's driving, and the houseboat does not go very fast, almost like the little engine that could. Put, put, put. It was estimated that it would take 4 days on the water to reach Canada. At this rate, I thought it could take us 4 months. We did have a nautical map, which might have been, well, had been written in Greek, because no one knew how to read it. Like most, my dad didn't like asking directions, so I was concerned when he said, "Just go straight ahead," which was east, "turn left," which is north, "and we'll run into Canada." After driving the boat for a while, my dad turned over the wheel to me. Surprisingly, I enjoyed being in control of the boat, even though I felt very small in this endless ocean all around us. But disaster was about to strike. Out of the blue, I hear this deafening sound, "Wah-woo, wah-woo," and turn to my left to see a mammoth ocean liner bearing down on us. My face looked like one of those Halloween ghosts with its mouth a big O. This was awful. We had realized too late that we had driven into the commercial shipping lanes of the Chesapeake Bay. My dad took over the wheel, and even at full power, we were just inching along. It was clear we were not going to be able to outrun this massive ship. We were going to get mowed down like a blade of grass. Miraculously, after several scary moments, the ocean liner veered around us, and we were saved. It did give us a few blasts of its horn, which sound like, "You idiots," because they knew we did not know what we were doing. But we're not out of harm's way yet, because the large wakes from the ocean liner caused our boat to rock violently back and forth. We were like a little tiny toy bouncing around in a tsunami. The waves made our boat rock violently, and the water was coming on the deck. My dad was in front steering the wheel as best he could to keep us afloat, with mountains of water crashing over him. The rest of us, me without a life jacket, were in the downstairs cabin huddled together for safety. I knew this was ridiculous, because when the boat capsized, you want to be on the deck to jump off. So I am plotting my escape up the ladder to get out of this cabin, which I feared would become our coffin. Gradually, the waves lessened and our boat stabilized and the weather got calm again. My dad came back to the cabin all wet and excited, all jazzed up. And the first thing out of his mouth was, "That was a hell of a ride, boys. We conquered Chesapeake Bay." Stunned and in shock, we yelled, "Hooray! We conquered Chesapeake Bay." Because even though he almost killed us, our dad was our hero.
All right. Okay. Now, if your dad was here right now and he heard that story, what do you think he'd say?
My dad would say, "What doesn't kill you makes you stronger."
Okay. Obviously, an adage that he created himself, right? One of the most popular adages that I love when you said he called us all boys. What do you miss most about your dad?
My dad was a great storyteller, and I love the way that he captured the room. He could keep hold people's attention.
Now, so many people say that. Yeah.
And yeah. I feel he is up in heaven, cavelling, proudly, listening to me tell my story.
And I have no doubt that that's a fact. But, you know, I was going to say, a lot of people say that. You know, he was a great storyteller. What do you remember most about your dad, your mom, your granddad? And that's one of the most common responses. They were great storytellers. They were really great inspirations, too. Well, I suppose this trip could have been worse. It could have begun with 3-hour tour, and that would have been a sign to get off the boat immediately, right?
Yes.
Martha is a very, very polite person. She always refers to me as professor. I really like that. So everybody out there in public, whenever you see me, just call me professor and bow. Okay, that's what I really would like. Robert Gonzalez is a communication major and plans to become a sportscaster. In fact, one reason he enrolled in a storytelling course is because when people tune into a sporting event, it's the sports announcer, he says, who tells the story as it unfolds. Robert, TV or radio, which do you prefer?
Whichever one has a job opening.
Whichever one has a job opening. There is no conceivable way I can think of a more reasonable answer than that, right? Who's your favorite sportscaster?
It is Ken Harrelson, the former play-by-play announcer for the White Sox.
You know, that is quite remarkable because he really is considered to be one of the top 10 announcers of all time. He is really pretty marvelous. Great, great role model. Tell us about a sporting event that you think spectators would enjoy best when the announcer tells the story well.
To me, I think there's nothing better than listening to an announcer telling a story in a baseball game.
Baseball game.
Yes. They're there watching every little detail and just picturing it for you.
And there are so many details, so many idiosyncrasies, and you're right, that an announcer has to talk about. You know, anything from pitching to ground balls to how long a home run is, things that we really take for granted when we're watching. And I guess you really have to be the eyes. You have to be the eyes of your spectators. Usually when people think about great sports announcers, they think about horse racing, right? You know, they're off. But baseball really is a great, great example. And speaking of baseball, it is the heart and soul of your two really excellent stories that you're about to tell. I love the stories that you're about to deliver, Robert, because one goes from tragedy to a miracle, and as you so eloquently stated in class, the other one goes from a miracle to a tragedy. Let's listen to your first story, a very moving narrative about your father.
Yes, so growing up, I'm pretty sure everyone has had memorable moments happen in their childhood that they take with them for the rest of their lives. Well, I'm no different, except that this memory just happens to be a tragedy, but then it turned into a miracle. So it was just a normal Sunday morning. We wake up, get ready to go to my dad's softball games. We get there, we interact with his teammates, tell everyone hi, how they're doing. my whole family's there as well. So we go over, hug everyone, see how they're doing. And my dad had two games that day, one at 9 and then one at 11. 9 o'clock game goes smoothly. Everything goes well. He wins. And we during that hour break, we eat. And then, as most softball players do, they decide to drink some beer. So the 11 o'clock game comes. I'm sitting on my mom's lap with an ice cream watching. And everything starts off normally. Dad gets a base hit. Next teammate gets a base hit. And then the next batter was our family friend, Larry. And he hits one into the gap. Now this field we're playing at has no fence. So the ball just keeps rolling into the outfield, just rolling, rolling. So my dad is hustling around third base, hits third, goes home. Steps on home plate, but then continues to run into the street and just starts throwing up. Now, me and my mom see this. We hop up. We go over to him, see if he's okay. But he's like, no, we need to go. So we pack everything up. We get into the car, and we go home. When we get home, my dad beelines for the bathroom. He gets into the bathroom and stays there for about an hour. After that hour, I run over to him, knock on the door, and say, Dad, are you okay? And then he tells me the scariest thing a five-year-old can be told. Go tell your mom we need to go to the hospital. So I run over to my mom, tell her that we pack up all the essentials and we head to the hospital. We get there, the nurses take him. And then a few hours pass, the doctor comes out and says he had a heart attack and he went into emergency surgery and it's not looking too good. So the doctor tells us that and we all just burst into tears. We're just like, wow, we can't believe this is happening. So then a few days pass, nothing has changed. The doctor just keeps telling us it's only a matter of time before he goes. So that day, my family comes to visit him. They see him in the state that he's in. And they just said, we need to start praying. So we go to a local church nearby the hospital. We just go in and just start praying. And then a few days later, the doctor comes and says he's actually doing a lot better than he was the previous day. And he's actually able to speak and you can go see him. So we go, he's sitting up in his bed talking to us. And we're just like, wow, our prayers worked. Then a few days later, he was sent home from the hospital. Now he is still living a healthy life.
What a wonderful story and what a relief. Have you ever told this story to your father?
I have not, no.
Yeah. Well, it would be an incredible gift. Your next story celebrates your love for your grandmother. And this one is the antithesis of what you just shared with us. Tell us this story.
Yes, so the previous story was a tragedy turned into a miracle. However, this story is a miracle turned tragedy. So again, growing up, my parents put me in baseball at an early age, and they thought it was a great time for the whole family to bond, you know, come watch me play every weekend, go out to eat afterwards. And one of my biggest supporters was my grandmother. She would go to every game, cheer everything I did, maybe get into a few arguments with a few other parents and coaches. But she was just adamant that, you know, practice makes perfect and you can be really good. So as I got older, you know, the field started getting bigger and bigger that I played on. And then nothing got bigger to when I was 12 years old. I finally get to play on the big field. That's basically high school level. So I was really scared to play on that field. I didn't think I would be able to hit on that field. But my grandma just reiterated, practice makes perfect. And if you practice hard enough, you can do anything. So that year I did. I practiced all I could. And then that year was actually my best hitting year I had playing baseball. Especially this one particular day. I stepped into the box. The pitcher threw basically a fastball right down the middle. I took the biggest swing I could. And I just started taking off for the bases. I hit first, went to second, hit second, went going to third. And my coach just had to be like, slow down. And I was like, why? He's like, you hit it over. And I was like, oh, okay. So I took my time going home because I was really tired running the other bases. But yeah, I actually hit a home run on a high school level field at 12 years old. I was very ecstatic. I look into the stands. My mom's happy, jumping up and down. So was my grandma. Teammates come out high-fiving. It was just the best moment of my baseball career. However, things changed a few weeks later. We got a call, and my tia, who my grandma was living at the time, said, grandma fell down the stairs. She's in the hospital. So we rushed over to the hospital to visit her. And just like they told me with my dad, they said, it's not looking too good. So a few weeks passed. She showed signs of getting better, but she still wasn't as healthy as she was. So the doctor said, we recommend you put her on hospice care. So her children, my tia, my dad, his brother, his other sister, they all decided, okay, yeah, we'll get hospice care and she'll live with my tia. So she goes in hospice care for about a few weeks. And then she actually came to one of my baseball games that year. They rolled her in her wheelchair. She was healthy enough to go out. She came and watched me play. And we went out to eat afterwards. But then the next day, we go to my dad's softball games. And before my dad could play, like 5 minutes before it was his turn to play, we got the phone call. Grandma passed. So we immediately rushed over to my tia's house to say our final goodbyes. And I actually had that home run ball I had with me in the car in a case, and I put it next to her to just remember that moment. She was proud of me.
Wow, what a wonderful story. What a powerful one. And it's almost as if your grandmother lived long enough to see you hit that home run. And I love the image that you're establishing with her being, you know, that ornery woman who would yell something like, you call that a strike? And she, you know, sounds to be that kind of a incredibly supportive woman. What a great story, Robert. Thank you. You know, there are a lot of lessons in every story, but what is the most important message that listeners should take from these two stories?
That life is short and you should spend every moment you have with your loved ones when you can.
Very poignant and very true. You know, it's an adage that we hear all the time, but we don't take as seriously as we should. As many people know, I suffered a loss this week. I was, my stepfather died. I was in Florida with my mother. And, you know, that's what everybody kept talking about, that life is short, life is short, life is short. And it never occurred to me how this adage is so incredibly true. It is short. And every day matters. Every day is that blank page that we have to somehow maximize and make better than the day before, the page before. So wonderful. Thank you so much. You know, So What Your Story started as an open journal, this program, in 2008. But a lot of you said, you know what, once a month just isn't enough. Stories are too important, too authentic, like the ones we're listening to tonight. We want it every week. Well, yeah, you got that. And we are now scheduled at really the best time of the week, 8 p.m. on Thursday, between the Progressive Forum with Houston legend Wally James and one of the most unique music shows around, Lars and the Tennyson Tape Deck. Thursday really is a great night for radio. DJs dropped a needle on songs you're only going to hear on this station because we are Houston's community station, KPFT. So go online, get in line. If you're out of line, that's okay too. Hell, even if you're in a lineup, go to kpft.org with your donations and call 713-526-5738 if you don't want to get online. This is Hank Rubicek, and you are enjoying my guest storytellers, Ninetsi Martinez, Robert Gonzalez, and Martha Barvin on So What's Your Story, only on KPFT, Houston's community station, on 90.1 FM, 89.5 in Galveston, and 91.9 in Huntsville. Just like tonight's tellers, don't think for a moment that you're not a storyteller, because everyone is. You just need a great place to prove it. And here's the perfect place. It's our sponsor, the Houston Storytellers Guild. We want you to zoom in every month, every Tuesday, fourth Tuesday of the month, by accessing the link on our website, www.houstonstorytellers.org. Our next swap is on May 25th from 7 to 8:30 p.m. And while you're on the site, why not become a member? It's easy and it's cheap to join. And enjoy all of our So What's Your Story program since 2008 under radio program on the menu. Also, please visit our So What's Your Story Facebook page for guest program information. And if you have ideas for our shows or guests, maybe even yourself, drop us a note at story@kpft.org, and I promise to get back to you. Our friends at The Moth may not be packing in a warehouse live, but themoth.org is one of the best places to enjoy some of the best stories on the planet. Another great place to turn for something very special is storycore.com. And if you're interested in taking your skills to the next level, why not become a member of the Texas Storytelling Association and the National Storytelling Network? You know, just a moment ago, I mentioned storycore.org as something very special. And if you're interested in why it's so special, I want you to listen to this short story about something that you would think you'd only listen to and see in a Lifetime movie. It would be easy, expected even, for Mary Johnson and O'Shea Israel to be enemies. After all, he killed Johnson's son in 1993. He went to prison for that, and toward the end of his sentence, he and Johnson made peace. As a teenager in Minneapolis, Israel was involved with gangs and drugs. One night at a party, he got into a fight with Mr. Bird, a 20-year-old, and shot and killed him. O'Shea is now 34. He finished serving his prison sentence for murder about a year and a half ago. Israel recently visited StoryCorps with Johnson to discuss their relationship and the forgiveness it is built upon. As Johnson recalls, their first face-to-face conversation took place at Stillwater Prison when Israel agreed to her repeated request to see him. I wanted to know if you were in the same mindset of what I remembered from court, where I wanted to go over and hurt you, Johnson says, Israel, but you're not that 16-year-old anymore. You're a grown man. And I shared something about my son with you. And he became human to me, Israel says. At the end of their meeting at the prison, Johnson was overcome by emotion. The initial thing to do was to just try and hold you up the best I could and hug you like I would my own mother. And Johnson says, after you left the room, I began to say, I just hugged the man that murdered my son. And I was stunned at doing that, as I instantly knew that all that anger and that animosity, all the stuff I had in my heart for 12 years, I instantly knew it was over and that I had totally forgiven you. Well, Johnson founded From Death to Life, two mothers coming together for healing, a support group for mothers who had lost their children to violence. And for Israel, Johnson's forgiveness has brought both changes and challenges to his life. "Sometimes I still don't know how to take it," he says, "because I haven't totally forgotten and forgiven myself. It's something that I'm learning to do. I haven't done it yet, but it's a process. I treat you as I would my son," Johnson says, "and our relationship is beyond belief. In fact, the two, listen to this, the two actually live right next door to each other in Minneapolis. So you can see what I'm doing. You know firsthand," Israel says, "and I like the fact that we're living together because of that." And if he falls out of touch, Israel is sure to hear it from Johnson, who calls out to him next door and says, "Boy, you haven't come over here to check to see if I've even taken out my garbage, to see if I'm alive." Johnson says that with a laugh. I find those things pretty funny because it's a relationship with a mother that feels like she's your mother, Israel says. "Well, my natural son is no longer here. I didn't see him graduate. Now you're going to college, and I'm going to have the opportunity to see you graduate," Johnson says. And she continues, "I didn't see him get married either. And hopefully one day I'm going to be able to watch you get married." Hearing those things, Israel says, gives him a reason to live, to reach every goal he's ever imagined. "It motivates me to make sure that I stay on the right path, that I stay on this earth. You still believe it in me when no one else did, and how much pain I caused her, how much pain I caused her, and still she's believing in me. It's amazing. I know it's not an easy thing, you know, to be able to share our story together," Johnson says, "even with us sitting here looking at each other right now. I know it's not an easy thing, so I admire you for being able to do that. I love you, lady. And I love you too, son." This was an interview that they shared with each other on StoryCorps, one that you can listen to on StoryCorps.org. But you know, Mary Johnson actually adopted Israel. He is now legally her son. I find this story to be more remarkable than anything you could ever imagine in life itself. Well, you guys have any impressions about that? What do you think, Nanetsi, Robert? Pretty incredible story, huh?
It's a crazy story to believe.
It is really crazy. You know, among other things, storytelling proves that expression isn't simply important, it's everything. And Nanetsi Martinez enrolled in storytelling because her desire to become a more comfortable communicator is inspired by her love of expression. She is a corporate communication major planning a career in public relations. Nanetsi, how'd you become interested in PR?
Well, I've been working customer service pretty much all my life, and I've come to realize that I'm good at creating relationships with others. And I realized that social media and keeping a good image is something that I've done in my current job. So I'm just trying to transfer skills that I'm good at.
Perfect. Beautifully said. And it is all about imagery, PR. Your story touched me. It's a story about your mother. And it's also a story that is surrounded by what I would refer to as childhood innocence. It sounds like a children's story almost. And it's a beautiful story. Tell us your story.
When I was a little kid, about 6 years old, next to our house, there was a small bayou. And on this day, a turtle from the bayou was in our backyard. Me and my little brother were so excited to go play with the turtle. We went to tell our mom, and she said, "You can look at it, but don't get too close because it can bite you." Me and my little brother went outside and decided to feed the turtle some long pieces of grass, trying to stay as far as we could so it wouldn't bite us, but completely ignoring what my mom had said about staying away. The turtle seemed to be enjoying the grass we were feeding it until a piece of grass got stuck in the front of his mouth. It was a long piece and it was just poking out it seemed as if the turtle couldn't reach it. Me thinking to myself, that piece is kind of long. I can probably poke the grass back into his mouth without getting bit. So I did. Not the smartest move. The turtle snapped back so fast I couldn't react fast enough and got my finger bit. All I wanted was for the turtle to keep eating his grass. A thank you would have been better. The exact thing my mom said would happen if I got too close to the turtle happened. I was shocked and grabbed my finger tight with my other hand, tight to keep the blood from going everywhere, and ran to my room while crying. As I'm running to the room, all I could think about was how mad my mom was going to be at me. I could already imagine her screaming at me. Still in shock, running to my room in disbelief, did I just get bit by a turtle? Oh no, I'm going to be in so much trouble. My mom is going to be so mad if I had just followed her directions. Now, inside my room, I'm just standing there crying, holding my finger when I hear, Gorda, ¿qué estás haciendo? Spanish for what are you doing? My mom found me in the corner of the room, holding my finger, still crying. But guess what? She wasn't mad and instead took me to treat my finger. The treatment and medicine for my finger hurt more than the bite the turtle had gave me. I should have listened.
Okay, let me ask you something. What inspired this story?
It just inspired me thinking of a moment where I got stuck in time. And I just keep on thinking on this moment where I just keep on thinking my mom is going to be mad at me.
Did it really hurt that much when that turtle bit you? We're just giving you a hard time. It's a snapping turtle. Of course it hurt a lot. Of course it hurt a lot. Now, I told you that I love the story because of the childhood innocence. Tellers. Elizabeth Ellis was on our show in 2014. She's not only one of the best tellers in the state, she's one of the best tellers in the country. And when she was on, she told this pretty magnificent story about motherhood. It's something that wowed a lot of people, and I think it's going to wow you too. So again, this is a story from 2014, Elizabeth Ellis.
Mississippi with my old friend Betsy Bishop. If you're ever homesick when you're out on the road, go to Denny's. You can pretend you're anywhere if you're at Denny's because they all look alike. Even the waitresses all look alike at Denny's. Betsy held up the tourist brochure and she said, we've been to everything that's listed here except their historic cemetery. And I said, well, it seems a shame to live Columbus, Mississippi without going to every site on their tourist brochure. After all, they printed it in color. So we went to the cemetery. Now, this was a cemetery that was made for the dead. We don't do that anymore. Mostly now we make cemeteries for the convenience of the living. If someone you love dies and you want to put a marker on their grave, you have to sink it in the ground for the convenience of the person who mows the lawn at the cemetery. But this was a cemetery that was old, when people still honored the dead with abandon. I was stunned by the different kinds of funeral statuary. They were everywhere. Couches and draperies made from granite or marble. Of course, there were depictions of Jesus. It was a southern cemetery. But the thing that struck my fancy were the angels. There were angels everywhere. There were angels kneeling, angels sitting, angels standing, angels dancing, angels flying, angels ascending. There were angels playing the harp. There were angels playing the trumpet. There were angels playing the drums. I was amazed to realize that heaven had a percussion section. That's a thought, you know. Betsy says to me, why don't you pick out one of these angels to be your angel and I'll pick out one to be my angel? I said, all right, we do that kind of thing. We walked a little bit further into the cemetery. I was looking at all those old-fashioned names on the stones. Finally, Betsy pointed to an angel. She said, that's my angel. It was a small angel sitting on the ground, feeding a lamb. Looked just like Betsy. The angel, not the lamb. Betsy said, which one's yours? I said, I haven't seen it yet. We kept on walking. I thought that we were coming to the end of the cemetery. But I spotted her right in the middle of a family plot. Like a lot of southern cemeteries, it had a little white picket fence around the graves that belonged to that family. The family named Teasdale, like the American poet, but not her people. Right there in the middle of that plot on one grave was an angel who had thrown herself prostrate on the grave in her grief. It almost looked like her marble shoulders were shaking in sobs. It cut me like a knife. My mother hadn't been dead for very long. I said, Bessie, that's my angel. She said, looks just like you. I raised my eyes, thinking that I would be looking at the end of the cemetery, and instead, I saw more graves in front of me than we had already walked past. But they didn't look like the ones we had walked by. These marched in rows of military precision, every single headstone exactly alike, spotless white marble. Even the inscription on the stones were exactly alike. Unknown Confederate dead. 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 Unknown. Till they disappeared completely out of sight. I looked to the left and was shocked to see an equal number of stones. These gray, the traditional domed shape. And as they marched across the brow of the hill, the inscription on every one of them said, unknown Union soldier, 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 till they disappeared out of sight. As I was trying to catch my breath, the caretaker of the cemetery came tootling up on his little three-wheel cart. And he asked us if we had found the grave that we were looking for because he was just sure that we were involved in some kind of genealogy project. And we told him we weren't looking for any grave in particular. We just like to go to cemeteries. And he gave us such a look. And he followed my line of sight, looking at all those matching gravestones. And he said, it's unbelievable, isn't it? I said, where did they come from? He said, well, you're standing in Mississippi, but you're just three stops down the train track from the Battle of Shiloh. I guess they buried all the men with names at the first two stops. I said, how many of them are there? He said, 55 acres. I couldn't draw in any breath. 55 acres of men without names who had died in the Battle of Shiloh. He said, you know, if you go home and you look on your computer, you can see that Memorial Day, it has a website. Everything's got a website these days. The website will probably tell you that some fancy Union general decided to start the idea of Memorial Day somewhere up north, I think 1868 or something. But we who live here in Columbus, Mississippi know that Memorial Day really started right here. Before the war was even over, the women of Columbus, Mississippi came to decorate the graves of the glorious Confederate dead. And nobody remembers the name of the first woman who stepped forward and said, but what about those boys over there? Their mothers are so far away. And so the women of Columbus, Mississippi went back to their gardens and they began to cut more flowers. They cut them by the wagon load, he said. And they didn't stop till they had decorated all those graves, all 55 acres. They decorated the graves of the men who might have caused the death of their husbands and sweethearts and brothers and sons. No matter what some fancy Union general says, Memorial Day story right here in Columbus, Mississippi. So, you know, this is my retirement. I go home every day. I try to stay up late enough to watch the 10 o'clock news. What I see scares me. I watch the news. It seems like we can't even be civil to one another anymore. We can't even have a conversation with people whose opinions differ from our own. I watch the 10 o'clock news and come back here and look at all these graves for all the men with no names. And I wonder if it could ever come to that again. Could American blood ever be shed here on American soil by other Americans? I tell you, when I watch the news and I come back and look at these graves, it scares me. Scares me. You know, if it ever happens again, all I can hope for is that when all the fighting's over, someone will step forward and say, but what about those poor boys? Their mothers are so far away.
You never get the StoryCorps story. You know, the woman who adopted the young man who killed her son, combined with this last story by Elizabeth Ellis about mothers who helped bury the young men who may have killed their sons, their husbands, their brothers, really do speak to the incredible power of a mother's love. Reminds me of a story. It sounded like a joke at the time, but there was a story that my grandmother told me growing up. She had a story for everything. And the story was that there was this young one and young man who wanted to get married. And the young woman made a demand. She said, if you want to marry me, you've got to murder your mother. Well, that's ridiculous, the young man said. I'm not going to murder my mother. Well, you can murder your mother and marry me, or not murder your mother and lose me. Which will it be? Well, the young man was ridiculous enough to listen to her, so decided to murder his mother. So one night when his mother was cooking dinner, he went into the kitchen, grabbed a knife, and stabbed her, seemingly to death. He was terrified, petrified, and panicked. He ran out of the kitchen, and he tripped. And as he tripped, his mother, who is not yet dead, uttered in her last breath, Billy, did you hurt yourself? That is a mother's love. I guess. You know, I wanted to give thanks to Lars for covering the slot last week while I was away mourning the death of my stepfather. You know, I've told a lot of stories on this show, at the Moth, in other venues, about my own father, my biological father, who left when I was 14. It was always a sad time in my life, but you know, my stepfather, Franklin, didn't just fill a void. He really was my dad. I thought about that a lot when I was away this past week, helping my mom recover and sort of deal with this, transition, this very challenging trajectory in her life. And I just wanted people to know that he filled more than a void. He really was my dad. And you're going to be so sorely missed. And, I was very glad. I was just glad that I could be there. And thank you to Robert Gonzalez, Nanetsi Martinez, and Marfa Barvin for once again proving the boundaries of the human heart can only be established through personal, heartfelt narratives such as the ones that they offered tonight. Can't thank you enough. They were beautiful, just absolutely beautiful. In 1948, Lewis Hill knew that there was something very special about listener-sponsored radio. So Pacifica was founded on the premise that freedom of expression is more powerful than corporate sponsorship. and that people, real people like you and I, would support that kind of station. Well, the Houston community has always been the center of our success here at KPFT. So let's keep it that way by donating as much as we can and by supporting this station as much as we possibly can, because we are Houston's community radio. Donating is easy. Just go to www.kpft.org or give us a call at 713-JAM-KPFT with your generous donations, and we'll always appreciate your support. Don't you dare move, because Lars is up next with the Tennyson Tape Deck, a sweet mix of singer-songwriters. We want you to keep 90.1 in your life every day. And while you're relaxing, and while you're just chilling and relaxing at home, we want you to make 90.1 something that you really are proud of by keeping it alive and well in this fabulous city. We want you to join us every Thursday on So What's Your Story at 8 p.m. and treasure what you hear. You keep loving a great story, and we're going to keep bringing them to you. I'm Hank Rubicek, and along with the rest of the So What's Your Story team, we never want you to forget that it is never too late to live happily ever after. Peace. Thank you.
First you listen, then you fall in love. You have your favorite programs that you listen to each and every week. And finally, you do the right thing by calling in that pledge of support to KPFT. You feel great, but guess what? Your job, it's not done just yet. You still need to fulfill your promise to KPFT by sending that pledge payment today. And when you do, you take that often forgotten last step. Don't wait any longer. KPFT depends on you.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times. That's my son. I love him a lot. And let's face it, it's been a hard year to be a mother. So we're gonna go beyond the bouquets and look at what policies mothers want most in the U.S. A new survey from the Institute for Women's Policy Research polled more than 1,400 women on their policy priorities for the new administration and Congress. C. Nicole Mason is the Institute's president and CEO.
This year, moms want a little bit more than breakfast in bed. They want paid sick leave. They want equal pay for equal work. They want child care. They want all the things they haven't had for so long.
President Joe Biden's American Families Plan, part of a larger economic recovery package, includes federal child care assistance, a minimum of 12 weeks paid family leave, and better pay for child care workers. Polling suggests most people like it. Critics in Congress say the $1.8 trillion price tag for the plan is too high. And a new analysis from University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School of Business estimates the plan will spend $700 billion more than Biden anticipates, mostly because they don't expect Biden to get as much tax revenue as he predicts. But Mason notes most women are breadwinners in their families, and the pandemic has made it clear what can happen when essential family work supports are missing.
We found out the hard way during the pandemic that women cannot do their jobs if they do not have adequate, high-quality childcare and paid sick leave. It's just not going to happen.
As of March, nearly 1.5 million fewer moms of school-aged children were actively working than a year prior, according to a Census Bureau advisor. Mario Cordona, chief of policy and practice of nonprofit Child Care Aware, thinks the American Family Plan's proposed universal pre-K, child care relief for low and middle income families, and increased investment in early learning is welcome and overdue.
The current system that we have for child care in this country is largely inaccessible for parents and relies on the low wages of early educators, who are largely women. About 40% of them are women of color.
Cordona notes there is an insufficient supply of child care available.
The lack of child care that exists in this country, it is so acute. Currently, about half of the population lives in a child care desert, which means they live in an area where there's an insufficient supply of licensed care.
Cordona says it will take time to build a new child care workforce that currently, mostly, does not exist. Finally, I'm sad to say this is my last 2021 Talks, but you're in good hands with Mary Sherman and Nadia Ramlagan. If you want to continue hearing from me, I'm going to be at Foreign Policy. Follow me on Twitter at L. Rosbrow, R-O-S-B-R-O-W. Erica Lattice contributed reporting. For Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Laura Rosbrow-Tellum. Thanks for listening.
Meetings of Pacifica Foundation Radio's Board of Directors and all of its standing committees, including KPFT's Local Station Board and Community Advisory Board, are open to the public. KPFT board and committee meetings and community advisory board meetings are posted in the events calendar of KPFT's homepage at least 1 week in advance of the scheduled date and also announced on the air. In addition, all Pacifica Foundation radio meetings are posted at pacifica.org under calendar with links to audio streams carrying telephonic meetings and audio recordings of those meetings. If a meeting is closed to the public, a written explanation of the reason for closing will accompany the meeting's minutes available at pacifica.org under calendar. If you want to be notified of meetings personally, please submit your email address to meetings@kpft.org or call KPFT at 713-526-4000 during business hours.
KPFT Houston.
Got a classic Beetle or some other automobile you don't know what to do with? Why not donate your car to KPFT? You can free up space in your garage, you can avoid the hassles of selling your car, there's no need to pay hefty car repair bills to keep it on the road, and you turn that unwanted car into an IRS tax deduction. In addition, by supporting KPFT, you're helping to make the Houston area better with unique arts, music, and culture programming. You help keep options on the airwaves.